Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on the establishment and authenticity of the Pali Canon. It is remarkable the skillful effort that has preserved the original teachings of the Buddha for the past 2,500 years, so that the true lineage of the Dhamma is present today. This talk was presented at our Tuesday evening Dhamma class in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on July 28, 2015. I hope you find benefit from this talk. Peace. Good evening, everyone. Does everyone have a general idea of what the Pali Canon is?
Yeah? The Bible of Buddhism.
It's the what?
The Bible of the Buddha.
Yeah.
It's the direct teachings.
That's a better description.
Because I read your email.
That was a test. It's actually, I don't know that I would call it the Bible of Buddhism, because hello, Gail. It's good to see you. Do you know when I say the Pali Canon, do you have a general idea what that means? Okay, good.
I have a general
hello,
idea.
Helen.
Yes. Hello.
Helen, when I the Pali Canon, do you have a general idea of what that?
Those
what,
are the writings of the Buddha.
Good, good. Well, let me read the article because I'll just repeat myself. And this is an article. I think I first wrote it maybe 3 years ago, and I've been adding a little bit to it. And the initial reason why I wrote it is that I was getting a lot of questions as to. So where do you find at least the original teachings of the Buddha? What about the later texts, and how did they come about? And I was on WDVR yesterday, and the DJ said, he said, Buddhism is so interesting, they keep adding more to it.
Oh.
Wow.
So it's more like one onion and you just keep peeling down to the center.
Yeah, I explained to him I'm a bit of a reductionist.
Yeah.
So the Pali Canon consists of three distinct collections, and they really are distinct. It is often referred to as the Tipitaka, the triple collection, or the three baskets. The first collection is the Vinaya Pitaka. And Pitaka really just means a smaller collection of books. The first collection is the Vinaya Pitaka. The Vinaya is a collection of rules for monastics, and it's a really interesting read because included in the rules are the reason why the rules were put into place. And these were rules that developed gradually. Most of them were put in place during the time of the Buddha, but then some were added later. And then there's, in the later developed schools, there's completely different books. But it's an interesting read in that way, but most of it is just practical teachings. There's a rule that you don't empty a spittoon off of a roof, and that's one of the Vinaya rules. It's interesting when you read about why it came to be a rule, though, because there was a visiting dignitary who happened to be walking along the side of a building when one of the monks decided it was time to clean the spittoon, and the Buddha thought it'd be a good, it was just practical. You don't do that anymore. Or at least be a little bit more mindful. It is the Vinaya Pitaka is valuable in understanding the political and cultural climate within which the Dhamma developed. The second collection is the Sutta Pitaka, and it contains all the discourses or suttas of the Buddha, and most of it is the direct teachings of the Buddha, but there's some teachings from monks and nuns. In fact, there's a really interesting collection, which is the teachings of nuns. And the reason why I find that so interesting is that there's not a lot of acceptance even today of nuns in certain schools of Buddhism, including Theravada, but that's changing. And the Buddha was often portrayed as being resistant to having nuns ordain, and it was just the opposite. He was concerned for their safety because of the political climate, that if he accepted nuns into the fold, that they would be murdered. You know? That was the sole reason. There are over 10,000 suttas in the five Nikayas, or the smaller collections in the Sutta Pitaka. The five Nikayas are I don't say these words correctly, but the Digha Nikaya, and these are the long discourses, and they're just that. They're the longer teachings of the Buddha. The Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses, just as the name refers to. The Samyutta Nikaya, and these are the group discourses, and they're grouped by themes. And I find that the Samyutta Nikaya is really the easiest to research and to read because of that, because they're grouped by themes. The Anguttara Nikaya, which is the expanded discourses, and they're grouped by the number of topics covered. In other words, the first book, there's 11 books in the Anguttara Nikaya. The first book has discourses related to one theme. The second book is related to two themes. Up to the 11th book, which has 11 different themes in the discourse that the Buddha's talking about, which is another interesting way to group things. When you're looking at... the reason why it's important is if you want to do some research on the Four Noble Truths, look into the Book of Fours. If you want to look at the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, look into the Book of Fours. If you want to look at the seven aspects of awakening, look into the Book of Sevens. And it's an easy way to do that type of research. The Kadaka Nikaya, the collection of short books, is just that. It's short books on a specific topic. There's a lot of repetition. You can cover the 99% of the Buddha's teaching by reading just one book, and then as you read it, if you're gonna do this, and I would suggest if you really want to get into it, stick to the Samyutta Nikaya, unless you got a lot of time on your hands. But
is the Pali Canon translated into all different languages?
Oh yeah, yeah. I would bet that it would have to be a very obscure language for it not to have a translation. And most of the translations are really good translations. The people that, I mean, you think about it, that wanted to do that work really cared about preserving the Buddha's teaching. In our language, Bhikkhu Bodhi and, there's a few. Nanamoli Thera did some really good translations. John Ireland, Thanissara Bhikkhu, is probably the most accessible and it's easiest to find online. Access to Insight is a website that has probably 80% of the Pali Canon translated. And Access to Insight, and it's listed on my website too. I do a lot of research on that. You know, you can plug in anything that you want to get some insight onto, and it'll take it to a bunch of suttas that will. And so the biggest difficulty in reading the Pali Canon is the repetition and some of the archaic language. A lot of the writings that I do that refer to the Pali Canon, I do my own little bit of translation. And by that I mean I bring it into more modern terms and less repetition, just because I don't think I'm losing anything, but that repetition can be really difficult.
Are there any translations that are not organized in the way that you described?
Not that I've ever come across. Mm-hmm. Because the original writings were grouped this way.
Okay.
And so the
yeah.
translations are grouped according to the way it was originally written.
Right.
And I might as well mention the repetition is there because there was the Pali Canon wasn't written down initially. It was preserved orally. And the best way to memorize anything is to repeat things over and over again. And that was the beginning of Buddhist chant, by the way. They used chant to memorize the teachings and also to teach it. It's just easier to say. When you say something over and over again, like I do.
When you sing it, too.
Yeah.
That's how we all learn the alphabet, by singing 26 characters.
Yeah, I'm going to start doing that. I'm going to start singing. The third basket. You know.
It might work.
It's not going to work. Believe me, it's not going to work. You will all develop great aversion to the Dhamma. I won't be here next week. I'll be in a nice little home with Padita. The third basket, the Abhidhamma Pitaka, contains the psychological and ethical teachings and also very mystical and magical sometimes it's presented as higher level teachings, and I don't agree with anything like that. The Buddha never taught anything higher level. Many scholars and practitioners disagree that the Buddha taught the Abhidhamma. I don't think he taught anything. I think the Abhidhamma is just interpretive. That's not to say it's not valuable to some people. I found it just inaccessible, you know. So I guess I would say it wasn't valuable to me, but many people do. The Pali Canon preserves the authenticity of the direct teachings of the Buddha, and this is due to the practical applications of the Buddha's teachings themselves. The essence of the Buddha's teaching is a personal and direct experience of the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha's own teachings provided the integrity needed to maintain the authenticity of the Pali Canon. So upon the Buddha's death, there was this first council, and 500 monks and nuns that had awakened gathered together to start preserving the Buddha's teachings. Now, you remember, these are awakened human beings who have developed a deep level of concentration already in their lives. And the two people that were mostly responsible for the initial recitation, Sariputta and Ananda had a photographic memory. And Sariputta did too, likely because of the way that they practiced. They meditated and developed deep levels of concentration. And they were able to retain the information that the Buddha was presenting on a daily basis. And so within a few weeks of his death, they got together and I'll read the article. Explains it better. The Buddha's teachings were memorized by senior monks and nuns contemporaneously and repeated in small groups to check for accuracy. These monks had extraordinary memories, likely due to their highly developed concentration. By repeating these memorized discourses, they were able to accurately maintain the teachings. This is likely the beginning of Buddhist chant. It was not so much a religious ritual as it was a most skillful way to preserve and present the Dhamma. This method of maintaining an accurate record of the teachings of the Buddha continued after the Buddha's passing. The first Buddhist council was held 3 months after the Buddha's passing. The purpose of this council and subsequent councils, there's been seven now, was to maintain the authenticity of the Dhamma. At the first council, the Buddha's chief attendant, Ananda, known to have a word-perfect memory, was interrogated on the teachings of the Buddha in front of the 500 or other monks and nuns. The other monks also had a complete and accurate memory of the Dhamma. So they were just testing Ananda within this group. And if Ananda made any mistakes, a monk would put up his hand and he'd say, I heard it this way, and they would discuss it. And they'd come to a conclusion as to what the Buddha actually said. And they were also preserving the intention. You know, these men and women understood what the Buddha was teaching and why he taught it. And that was so important in maintaining that intention. Ananda was present at every discourse presented by the Buddha during the last 25 years of his teaching. He was questioned on verifiable facts about place of discourse and the person or people the discourse was presented. Often you'll hear a sutta begin with, thus I have heard. And that's what it's referring to, that they heard it directly from the mouth of Ananda. And it's another way to just kind of check what you're reading. It was accepted that Ananda retained a true, accurate, and complete account of the Buddha's teachings. Over the next 7 months, the 500 monks recited their own memories of the Buddha's teachings. These recitations were compared for consistency and accuracy. It was then accepted by the entire council that what was presented was an accurate and complete presentation of the teachings of the Buddha. And so now they had an agreement that they could check with each other as they continue to spread the Dhamma. Are we remaining true to what the Buddha taught? Because remember, it was still going to be a while before any of this was written down. The method of recitation and comparison continued through the later Buddhist councils. The second Buddhist council met approximately 100 years later, and the third council approximately 120 years after the second. At the fourth Buddhist council in Sri Lanka in 29 BCE, a written account of the teachings of the Buddha was first recorded. And there's some debate that maybe the written record took place at the third council, but there's nothing clear. And it really doesn't matter. That 120-year difference really doesn't matter all that much, because the same method was maintained throughout, and so the integrity of the teaching. It would have been very obvious if anything was changing over the period of time.
So it's just verbally transmitted to others who then carried it on through the centuries.
Yeah, and they kept coming back in these councils to continue to check for accuracy, and then it was finally written down.
Yeah,
when the Buddha himself was speaking, he was often speaking for hundreds, if not thousands, of people.
Oh, well, anywhere from one person to thousands, yeah.
It's pretty difficult for one person to address 1,000 people in the open air. Did they have some kind of a mechanism where people would kind of repeat what he was saying to the guys?
I've never come across that. Well, now that you mention it, there's stories in the Pali Canon where the Buddha gave a teaching and then monks and nuns would go out into the... So you're right. They would go out into the crowd and present the teaching to people that might not have heard it. So, yeah, that's a good point. So
they were kind of already doing what they were doing at the first council.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, before they even started... before the 500 came together, they were already going out and teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Buddha wasn't the only one teaching the Dhamma during his own life. You know, many of the monks and nuns had awakened. And it wasn't that big of a deal. You were kind of expected to awaken.
Those people that went out and taught during the Buddha's lifespan weren't necessarily repeating his own words verbatim. They were speaking the teachings in their own way.
In their own way, but they were very careful to maintain the integrity of the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also pretty easy to do because the Buddha didn't teach anything mystical or magical.
Right.
He was very direct and very practical, and he always taught in context of developing understanding of the Four Noble Truths. He wasn't interested in teaching anything else. That's why there's a lot of question in the Abhidhamma, because that gets into conceptual higher levels of consciousness and some kind of paranormal stuff too. The Buddha, again, never taught anything like that. He just taught people how to awaken. And another good way of checking your own understanding, especially if you start getting confused with some concepts, is remember that the Buddha taught everything to develop understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And so when the Buddha described awakening, he described it in a very simple and direct way. Suffering has been understood or comprehended sometimes. That's awakening. Understanding the nature of suffering. Clinging has been abandoned. Cessation has been experienced. The path leading to the cessation of suffering has been developed. That's the Buddha's description of awakening. Again, so everything he taught was to develop awakening. And it sounds pretty mundane unless you understand the complete ramifications of suffering and how we deal with it as clinging individuals. And that basically comes down to we become very distracted because we want things to be different than they are. We want things that give us pleasure to stay forever because we've attached to it. And anything that might bring us displeasure, we create aversion for it. And all of that is a distraction. And the distraction means that we stop living our lives. We're no longer present for what's unfolding. And, well, let me finish the article. I'll get into something else. The fifth Buddhist council held in Burma in 1871, and the most recent sixth council in Rangoon, there was a later one recently. It wasn't, I don't want to get into it. But if you hear about the Seventh Council, take it from me. Don't pay any attention to it. It was more of a political thing about reconciling the Dhamma rather than maintaining the original integrity.
Well, like who comes to the one in 1800?
Most of it are representatives of all the different schools.
They are.
Up until the last one.
Yeah.
there was no Theravadan representation at the last one. And I don't want to get into the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was mostly a way of saying, you know, the old way wasn't really accurate. And they tried to justify the arising of the later Mahayana texts it was always claimed that the Buddha gave these later teachings in a disincarnate, a heavenly realm, and it was protected for many centuries by the snake people, and until human beings were ready for this more advanced teaching, and then it sprung up over the years. And, you know, maybe, but the problem with the later teachings is they're not consistent with what's in the Pali Canon. And the Buddha said repeatedly that he taught the whole Dhamma. So either the words were recorded wrong, or the Buddha was a type of a sociopath, that he could lie that well. I mean, really, he would have to be to justify... again, I'm getting into something I'd rather not get into. To justify the excuses made for the later developed school, later developed teachings. And the... there's three suttas that the later schools are built on. They're beautiful suttas, the Heart Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, and the Platform Sutra. The Platform Sutra is recognized that it came from Wei Neng. It's not even attributed to the Buddha. The Platform Sutra is the sutra that most of Zen Buddhism is built on. The Heart Sutra is a Mahayana text that develops the idea of emptiness. Everybody, you've all heard the line, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, etc., etc. That comes out of the Heart Sutra. And then the Lotus Sutra, which is another well-known later developed sutra, is the foundation for Pure Land Buddhism. And Pure Land Buddhism states that the Lotus Sutra is the only sutra that the Buddha ever really meant to give. And in the beginning it says something like, these are the words of the Buddha that... It basically says the Buddha is saying this is the thing you should listen to. Mm. Well, if you want, that's fine. But again, there's nothing in the Lotus Sutra that relates to anything else that the Buddha would have taught. And I'm not trying to be controversial or put down anything, but what I am trying to point out here is that there's a set of books that more than likely preserves the original intent and teachings of the Buddha, and if practiced, will develop lasting peace and happiness. The Pali Canon comprises the teachings followed by the Theravadan school of Buddhism, mostly. Theravadan Buddhism has influence throughout Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, and now the West. There are an estimated 100 million people worldwide who consider themselves Theravadan Buddhists. Somebody asked me the other day if I consider myself a Theravadan Buddhist, and I said no. I said no. I just don't. I don't see any reason to define myself that way. Due to the method used to maintain the integrity of the Pali Canon, Theravadan Buddhism is the least culturally and philosophically influenced of modern-day Buddhism. And that's kind of interesting how that came about. Theravadan Buddhism has remained consistent with the original teachings of the Buddha through the adherence to the Pali Canon. Theravadan Buddhists integrate, again, for the most part, the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path, as the way of liberation and freedom. The meditation method used, again, for the most part, is Shamatha Vipassana meditation. In some branches, though, a greater emphasis is placed on vipassana meditation, insight alone. Theravadan Buddhism has remained consistent with the Pali Canon, and this may be a result of where Theravadan Buddhism spread. The areas to which it spread were geographically isolated and were not as culturally and philosophically influenced as the Mahayana schools. So as Buddhism spread first to China and then back up north into Tibet, and then back down into Japan and Korea, it was strongly influenced by the society in which it spread through. In China, Taoism and Confucianism was very popular, kind of state religions. And so Buddhism was adapted towards Taoism and towards Confucianism. There's aspects of that to make it more acceptable. And as it went back up into Tibet at the time had, and Bon, B-O-N, is still a major religion there, a very shamanistic type of religion. So those aspects were brought into Tibetan Buddhism and are still there today. And the same thing happened in Japan and the culture of Japan and Korea. Theravadan Buddhism, as Buddhism spread directly south to Sri Lanka is just, those of you that know India, it's kind of just off the southern coast of India, really had no established religion and not a well-established culture. And so it wasn't influenced as much by those other cultures. And as Buddhism then spread back into like Laos and Cambodia way back, again, the societies weren't well-established, and so it wasn't as heavily influenced. Now that's not so much the case. But it's in those other, in Sri Lanka, Laos, Cambodia, where... until modern times, Buddhism was not heavily changed to accommodate the culture.
What year would that be that was introduced?
Well, it first went into Sri Lanka about, I don't know if I have it here, I think it's about 300 years after the Buddha's death. It was pretty quick.
So after the year would that be?
250 BC?
Yes, about that. About, yeah, 200 before the... Yeah. And then after it had the northern spread and then back up into Tibet and Nepal, back into Japan and China, it continued that spread from Sri Lanka too. And as these became two distinct schools of Buddhism, and there was the later developed schools, which you could call the Mahayana school today. That wasn't even that clearly defined. And as there started to become a feedback into the homeland, into India, this is a really interesting part. There was a sect called the Mahasanghikas, which really wanted a more visionary and more mystical type of Buddhism. And it's the Mahasanghikas that said, or took it upon themselves is probably a more accurate way of saying, that the Buddha was a god. They started changing the direct teachings at the time. The Buddha was a god, and there's been many more gods before him. And they started changing the purpose of the Dhamma from personal awakening to societal salvation. And they started interjecting these more mystical and esoteric views into the Dhamma. And they, of course, they had a right to do it. They were, at the time, they were part of the Buddhist Sangha in northern India. Once that happened, and you remember too that there was no internet. Travel was very slow, so it was slow. They were slow in expanding their reach, but their reach followed into China, and it followed that same route. And so the Mahasanghikas had even a later influence on the development of Buddhism in those other countries. The southern form of Buddhism, which you can now call the Hinayana, which means lesser vehicle, and the Mahayana means the greater vehicle, was continued to be influenced by what would become the Theravadins of today, the ones that kept to the original teachings of the Buddha. And that split is still here. It's still what, I mean, I'm talking about it 2,500 years later, you know, and the implications of it. I'll just get into that a little bit. The original meaning of Hinayana related to geography. Not Hinayana now is called the lesser discourse in almost a derogatory way, which, like, meaning that it's not the greater discourse. It's not Maha. Maha means greater. But originally, Hinayana describes the lower vehicle or the southern vehicle. It's just describing the route that Buddhism took. It went this form of Buddhism went south. And it took the southern route to establish itself. Mahayana, or greater vehicle, describes how that branch spread, as Buddhism spread. Mahayana Buddhism spread from India north, it spread south into China, but then north into Nepal and Tibet, and hence the definition of the upper vehicle. It really is just a geographical look at it. The first Mahayana text or sutras appeared around the first century. And this is also the time when a somewhat magical and mystical idea of receiving the Dhamma through a mind-to-mind transmission developed. Again, this is going back to the Mahasanghika sect, that the practical applications was not so important as the development of the mind and these higher levels of concentration. Again, it's not something that the Buddha taught, but they were enamored with the idea of the mind transforming in a magical and mystical way. And there's still that today. There's still this idea of a mind-to-mind transmission of the Dharma. And, you know, your teacher, through a mind-to-mind contact, is going to transmit this understanding to you, and you will then be awakened.
Did they introduce transcendental meditation as well?
No. Transcendental meditation was something completely separate from the Buddha. Transcendental meditation was originated, I think, by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was really a brilliant man. But he was mostly a Hindu practitioner. He didn't consider himself. I don't even know if he knew much of actual Buddhist teachings. The method I started with Transcendental Meditation. It's the first method I ever used. And it's pretty good for developing somewhat of a calm and peaceful mind. But there's nothing else taught, and it's not taught in any context. It's just taught to, you know, and it's a mantra-based meditation method. You're given what I was told was a secret mantra. I found out later that they're not so secret. What I found after about 2 years of Transcendental Meditation was that it didn't seem to be doing much besides giving me a way of calming my mind, which was nice, but I still had this calm but troubled mind. I still didn't understand what was going on with me and my world. And so I started looking outside of TM. It was a good way to start, I think. For me, I don't know that if people ask me where should I start, I don't tell them to go to TM. I tell them to probably come here. I just mentioned that. The Buddha presented the Dhamma in the form of Four Noble Truths to be understood and acted upon. He taught that to gain understanding, one would take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. It is within refuge that understanding arises. And I'm talking about the idea of mind-to-mind transmission. So the Buddha taught a very specific way of developing awakening. And it has to do with us getting to know our own minds, not getting to know somebody else's mind or interpretation of the Dhamma. His teachings, the interesting thing about the Pali Canon is his teachings never changed. He didn't develop a more advanced teaching as he taught. He taught the same thing consistently for 45 years. And it's a simple and direct path for any human being to engage with and awaken. It's not contingent on another person giving you anything except a clear explanation of the Dhamma. You know, there's people that would argue with this, but any good teacher of the Dhamma is only teaching what they know. Hopefully, I'm somebody like that. The Buddha cannot awaken anyone, and nobody subsequent to the Buddha can awaken anyone, but the Dhamma can. And so when we're taking refuge in the three jewels, we're taking refuge in the understanding that a human being did just this, and he showed us the way, we're taking refuge in his Dhamma, how to do it. And as a group, we get together as a Sangha and take refuge in our own developing understanding. There's so much support that happens in this room and in other Sanghas that are well-focused. I really believe that one of the questions that came up yesterday is, you know, what about... what's the importance of meditating with a group? And he was surprised when I said it's the most important thing you can do. It may be even more important than the method, but I don't think so. But, you know, you need the right method. But the Buddha gave us this very simple, maybe I'll wind it up because I'm only halfway through this. He gave us this very simple way of developing awakening, of putting aside all the causes of stress and unhappiness in our lives to fully mature as human beings. And he spent 45 years teaching it. And that teaching is presented in the Pali Canon. There's nothing in the world that says we must follow the Pali Canon. We must follow the original teachings of the Buddha. But he didn't teach anything else. So, again, as the question came up yesterday about being a Buddhist, I don't consider myself a Buddhist. I do consider myself someone who develops awakening through the Eightfold Path and develops understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It doesn't fit into a nice term. I'm a Four Noble Truther. You know, and if somebody, it's easy to call myself a Buddhist, and the only reason I have a little hesitation is because that has such a broad definition today that it really is kind of meaningless. What's most important is what's most important as a human being who's interested in awakening according to the Buddha's teachings is to follow the Buddha's teachings. It doesn't mean we shouldn't even look at other schools. You know, I still have an interest in what's going on in Tibetan schools and Zen schools, kind of see what's going on. But as far as my own practice, I keep it focused on the Four Noble Truths. That's all. I think that's as far I've made my point about the Pali Canon and how it developed, how the integrity's been maintained, and how important it is. If you want to read more about the Pali Canon outside of what's on my website, Bhikkhu Bodhi's books are great. John Ireland's books are great. Thanissaro Bhikkhu has a lot of good free writing about the Pali Canon and the Buddha's direct teaching. And you his website is Access to Insight, but also it might be dhammabooks.com or something, or .org. But if you do a search on, you can go through the website. I have links to that. But it's really interesting reading. And the most interesting aspect of it is the consistency throughout those 10,000 or so pages of books. So that's the teaching. Any questions about what I talked about tonight?
Why did it take so long to get committed to writing?
It wasn't. For one thing, there was no form of. That's not even true. There was a form of writing, but the monks. It wasn't common. You know, it just wasn't something that people did. It wasn't. Yeah, it just wasn't there. Nobody knew to do it.
I think there's still cultures in India where it's still the oral tradition and things are memorized and they go like a town caller and go from town to town and bring the news.
Yeah, and it's a very accurate way of preserving anything.
There was a great program on the Moth Radio recently about it.
Wow.
I'll look and see. I think I wrote down.
Yeah, let me know. It'd be really interesting. And you also have to remember that this was their life. You know, their life was devoted to the Dhamma and the Buddha's teachings and teaching others. You know, they didn't have a lot of other distractions then either. And that remained true for many years.
But now the council, so many years later, are not in the same boat as those people who that was their whole life. So, you know, they all get together as a council to see what is the, you know, where they're going or make sure everything's okay. Would they go back and look at the Pali Canon for reference to make sure everything's following that? Or would they just have their own ideas?
It's a good question, Gail.
It's kind of modern in the 18 and 1900s compared to, you know, back then.
There's more and more of a push. And this really started happening as Buddhism spread into the West, which was really mostly England and the United States. But, to reconcile the teachings, to come up with kind of a unified Buddhist teaching. And, you know, again, maybe that's a good thing. But from what I've seen, so much is lost. And in the original intent, you know, just as the Buddha describes awakening, that is lost. That's given. It's not even seen as a purpose. You know, why should we understand suffering? Suffering is glorified almost in a way. The individual and the individual's views takes precedent rather than recognizing where these ego-centered views are arising from and so eventually it contradicts what the Buddhist teaching was. What was to recognize that who I am is not a self worth preserving, and to let go of all views. So, you can say that it's modern, and well, this is just the way things are, and I guess it is. The Buddha said at one time that there would come a time when the teachings would be gone, and maybe, you know, I think we're close to it. And again, I keep having to say this: I'm not against anything except. Why not? If you're gonna practice Buddhist, if you're gonna be a Buddhist, I'm not a Buddhist. If you're gonna be a Buddhist, why wouldn't you want to first understand what the Buddha taught, rather than adapt it to something else? And I feel that way because I was so confused for so many years, and I talk to a lot of people that are very confused. The Dhamma is a very simple and direct way of awakening, of fully maturing as a human being. But all of us are collectively conditioned to think that it's something else, and that makes it very difficult. We don't want to recognize the simplicity of it because there's so much complexity. And so this last council had more of a focus. What it really was, how do we modernize these teachings? And to most people, that sounds like a great idea, doesn't it? Well, we should modernize it. It'll be accessible to more people. more people will become Buddhists. That all sounds wonderful until you realize that that's exactly what's been taking place for 2,500 years. It makes perfect sense, except it just doesn't. It's not helpful. And the other thing is that the Buddha's teachings, direct teachings, don't need to be changed. They can apply to any human being. They really are. When you look at what he taught, they're timeless. They really are timeless. They apply as well today as they did 2,500 years ago. I mean, and that's remarkable to me. There's not one thing that I've ever come across that I said, you know, this doesn't apply to me, or this doesn't apply to modern times. Because he was directing his teachings at the common human problem of stress, of dukkha, of confusion, you know, of disappointment. And we all have that. No matter how wonderful our lives are, there's always this underlying kind of disappointing notion of with life. It's just not great enough, you know. There needs to be more. And that more is that who I think I am is not it. And because of the conditioned thinking that I have, I don't recognize how much more I truly am. Good questions. Any other questions before we meditate? We'll go around the room quickly later, too. It's not all that late. So as we meditate, just think about that. This meditation method, Shamatha Vipassana, is what was taught. It's what the Buddha taught as part of the Eightfold Path. And it's here to develop deep concentration so that we can recognize clinging and abandon all the causes of suffering. So the most important aspect of meditation is just that, develop concentration. When we notice that we're distracted by our thoughts or maybe some feelings that are arising, come back to the sensation of breathing. And that simple act of coming back to the being mindful of the breath starts interrupting conditioned thinking, and it keeps us focused within this framework of the Eightfold Path. So find your relaxed meditative posture, keeping your back straight but not stiff, ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel, and holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your cushions. Settle into your bodies. And settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath and your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath and your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. And when you notice that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.